From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 10 million young Indians are entering adulthood every year, optimistic, impatient, striving. What is waiting for them in a country with strong economic growth, political corruption, and free speech restrictions in this social media age? We'll look at the promises and obstacles this hour on Point, India's aspiring youth in today's India. You can join us on air or online. What are your perceptions of modern India? As a country whose youth are surpassing our own, or a country with great challenges for the next generation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we remember Nancy Reagan, but first here, joining me from New York, Somini Sengupta. She covers the United Nations for the New York Times and was former bureau chief in Dakar and New Delhi. Her new book is The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Somini, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the title of the book, The End of Karma. Define karma for us here and the meaning behind the title.
You know, The End of Karma really refers to what I found when I was researching the stories of these young people. They were all born with one destiny, and they're trying to make another. So they're really trying to overcome their past. And that's what I try to capture in the stories that I tell.
And
the book is really about three generations of Indians. The generation that my father belongs to, he was born just before independence. He's part of what has been referred to as Midnight's children. It's somewhat about my generation because I'm always wondering, you know, what kind of a person I would have been like had I stayed in India. And most importantly, it's about the generation of Indians who come of age after 1991, which is when the economy starts opening up. And really what I learned from telling their stories is what you were talking about in the introduction, is that this is a generation that is really filled with aspiration. Their expectations run very, very high. But as I write in the book, aspiration is like water. It needs a place to go. And so that's a real challenge for India's leaders. You know, it's hard to imagine that India can really achieve its enormous potential without giving its young people a fair shot.
Well, there's so many different perceptions of India, as you know, especially in the United States. On one hand, we have a picture of smart strivers, especially in high technology. On the other hand, a third world country with economic and social constraints. Talk more about how the reality stacks up against the image.
Right. And as an aside, I can't help but point to the Coldplay Beyoncé video that was recently shot, I think, in Bombay, once again showing India as a land where people throw colors on each other all the time. But in fact, and it's not holy in India 24/7. That is also part of our perception, somewhat wrong-headed perception, of an enormously diverse and complex country.
Let me play a part of it while you bring that up here. This video had 21 million hits on YouTube during its first couple of days of release. Here is Hymn of the Weekend, Coldplay featuring Beyoncé. So, Somini, you know, peacocks in this video, temples, fire eaters, holy men, dancing girls. I mean, a lot of people say this is a collection of cliches. Is it a misrepresentation of the new India?
Well, I got to say, Beyoncé looks fantastic. And the song is great. But as you were pointing out, there are really two Indias. There are many Indias. Yes, in a country of 1.2 billion people, of course there are some real standouts, people who are very well educated, who have some of whom have come to this country and done incredible things, particularly famously in Silicon Valley. But it's also a country of a lot of young people who are trying to remake themselves and who find that there isn't quite anything resembling a level playing field. So nearly one in four Indians still live in dire poverty, living on under $1.25 a day. 30% of Indian children under five remain clinically malnourished, which doesn't mean that they're just, you know, hungry every now and then. It means that they're going to be intellectually stunted for the rest of their lives.
Right.
One in three is still not immunized against childhood diseases. And so it's, again, it's hard to imagine how India fulfills its enormous potential without giving all of these young people really, you know, the some equality of opportunity. And why does it matter now? Because there are just so many young people in India. The numbers are quite mind-boggling. The number of Indians between the ages of 15 and 34 is over 400 million, 420 million, which is more than the population of the United States, Britain, and Canada combined.
Mm.
It's huge.
So talk about economic growth, because you mentioned those terrible numbers, one in four in dire poverty, one in five with clinical malnutrition, one in three not immunized. And yet, 7% economic growth year to year. You've got all of these people. You know, is the economy growing fast enough to accommodate these young people with these, you know, many of them with these dire, under dire circumstances?
That's a great question. The economy is growing very fast. It's a very attractive market for all kinds of companies, including American ones. It is it's attracting foreign investment in with very handsome numbers. But it also faces this incredible challenge that you were alluding to in the introduction, with so many people coming of age and coming into the labor market. How does India create what is estimated to be somewhere between 10 and 17 million jobs every year? I mean, that's just a mind-boggling number for any country. And along with that is the challenge of preparing those young people to have the education, to have the skills, to have the health to participate in the economy. So I think that's an enormous challenge that we can go back to.
I remember reading an article in the New York Times several years ago with the headline, "They have more honor kids than we have kids." But you write in your book that public education in India is really in bad shape. Teachers don't often show up for work, even though more students are going to school than in the past. Many are not learning. What's the disconnect here with regard to education?
You know, it's a really it's a complex story, because if you look at India's 70-year history, the gains that it has made since independence are remarkable. If you were an Indian child born, an Indian baby born when my father was born, your chances of dying as an infant were far greater than it is today. Fewer than half of all Indian children around the time of independence were in school. By and large, Dalits were not in school. Those are the people at the very bottom of the caste ladder. Many girls were not in school. That's shifted remarkably. Now, nearly all Indian children are in school, including girls in primary school. But here's the big but. When you look at what they're learning, 50% of all fifth graders, these are children who are coming to school. They're staying in school for 5 years. Well, 50% of them cannot read a second grade textbook. 50% of them can't really do a simple subtraction problem. And these are statistics that I'm citing from a very important and innovative NGO in India, a non-governmental organization called Pratham, which year after year goes out and really tries to measure what Indian school children are learning. And these are some of the alarming statistics. And if I could tell you one story, I remember going out with these evaluators several years ago to a village school way out in the north of India. And I remember going early in the morning, going to a village, and the mist was just rising from the fields. It was a cold and crisp day. And I remember seeing just streams of children, you know, coming from home, coming to this one schoolhouse. And they were bringing with them these rice sacks that they would flatten out and sit on because, of course, there were not enough benches inside the classroom for all these children who were coming. And they were sitting on the patio in the front yard in front of the school. And, you know, the teachers were completely overwhelmed. The teachers who did show up were not doing very much other than taking attendance. And I remember the young social worker who took me there, he said to me at the end of the morning, looking really just so frustrated, he said, you know, when these kids grow up, they're going to curse us. They're going to say, we came to school every day and we learned nothing.
We're talking about India's young and the future they face this hour. You can join the conversation. Are India's youth ahead of the world or behind? Do they face the same challenges as young adults here in the United States? This is Jai Ho from the 2008 movie Slumdog Millionaire. We're going out on this. We'll be back after this break. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the future of India's next generations this hour, and you can join the conversation. Is the world's largest democracy delivering for its young people? Indian Americans, how does the future look for India in your eyes? We're speaking this hour with New York Times' Sumini Sengupta, whose new book is The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. And joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Tarun Khanna, professor at Harvard Business School and director of Harvard University's South Asia Institute. He's author of Winning in Emerging Markets, a Roadmap for Strategy and Execution, and Billions of Entrepreneurs, How China and India Are Reshaping Their Futures and Yours. Professor Khanna, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Nice to be with you. Hi, Sumini.
So we've heard what Sumini's been talking about here. How do you see it? How do you see the challenges for India's young? There's this huge demographic bulge coming, or maybe it's already there. What are the challenges associated with that?
So everything that Sumini said and you implied, Jane, in your comments strikes me as correct. You know, a long time ago, there was a lovely book, kind of depressing, but a nice book that V.S. Naipaul wrote, India, A Million Mutinies Now. And I was reminded of that when I was reading Sumini's book this weekend. And I also, you know, found myself fixating on the title of one of the chapters. That's the excerpt on your webpage also, Aspiration Like Water. And I think that really is the key to understanding the massive social transformation that Sumini chronicles and strikes me as being absolutely right, that there is this pent-up ambition, pent-up frustration sometimes, and the challenge for those of us who are fortunate enough to be on the other side of this divide between the haves and the have-nots, in other words, on the have side, is to somehow facilitate the transition of those who are aspiring but unable to actuate those aspirations.
Well, I was going to say that's exactly to the point of a listener from our website who says the one point of concern regarding the rise of India is their innate class system. There is no acknowledgement that all people are created equal. In fact, some people are so inferior they are not to be touched. Professor Khanna, how do you see the caste system in India evolving with this new generation and the inequality in India?
You know, anybody who's been reading the headlines lately will see that there's a lot of tension in the country having to do with some voices being suppressed and so on and so forth. But the one hopeful news, I think, in the last 20 or 30 years, which we shouldn't lose sight of, is that a lot of ways in which, whereas caste, of course, has been heavily politicized, dysfunctionally politicized in an unfortunate way, at least caste is not your karma, to use Sumini's title. It's not your predestiny anymore. particularly if you're in the urban or semi-urban areas. It's increasingly possible in my experience, and I operate a lot on the ground in India, both as an academic and as an entrepreneur. It's increasingly possible for you to transcend the limitations of your caste. And thanks to the efforts of a lot of entrepreneurs, including the likes of Pratham that are civil society entrepreneurs, and the likes of private sector folks out to make a buck doing something productive, it's possible for a young person who can demonstrate that he or she has some talent or skill, whether it's a high-end cognitive skill or a language skill or a low-end vocational skill, to enter the mainstream and to participate more fully in the promise of a future. Now, that's not to say that there's not a lot of problems, a huge numbers of problems, but, you know, I tend to be an incorrigible optimist.
I know that about you, yes. Samini, talk about that. Well, have you seen examples of that, Samini, on the ground in India, of Indians being able to transcend their caste?
This is where the parallels with the United States are so, so striking. The Indian Constitution remarkably guarantees equality under the law. And yet, India was, as you say, India has a long tradition of treating people unequally, which is the caste system. Similarly, the United States promises equality under the law, and yet we were founded on chattel slavery. And I think young people there and here increasingly expect to be treated as equals under the law and in government services, which explains in large part the remarkable movement that you see here in Black Lives Matter. So I think absolutely Tarun is right in the sense that young people no longer expect that the caste into which they were born will define who they will become.
Let's get a call in here. Vijay from Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to share my story. I come from a small village near Bangalore in India. I literally grew up in like a slum area, where I walked barefoot until I was like 23. I didn't have, you know, toilets and you know, we literally didn't even buy vegetables, fruit, anything. We just go collect in the farms and then eat them and things like that. But I went to a school where there are only two teachers until like kindergarten through fifth standard, and then they would barely teach you anything. But, you know, what I notice in India is that parents take a tremendous interest in teaching the kids to learn and then to become educated and so on. And that made me get a degree in India and then come to USA, and then I was able to finish my PhD. That was a remarkable success story. And compared to, well, I grew up in the, you know, 90s when India was really opening up its economy. And when I compare that to what those days and today my brother was able to start a business, and then, you know, he's employing few people. The transformation is remarkable compared to what I see back in those days to today. But I still think that the opportunities, for instance, if I want to go back and then, you know, see a bright light there, mm-hmm. I think it's not quite there yet.
Not quite there yet. Vijay, let me pick it up there. I appreciate your call. Tarun Khanna, do you agree?
I think Vijay is exactly right that, you know, his own personal story is heartening to the rest of us. And there's room to work at it much more. One thing, Jane, that I'd point out is that I think is very hopeful is that for the first time, at least in the last 20 years, you're finding that the government and the private sector are learning, with an emphasis on learning, to come together to try to work on these problems together. In a sense, thanks to the efforts of some people, including some people who are profiled in Somini's book, it's no longer anathema for the government to deal with the private sector. Private sector used to be a bad word in India when I was growing up in Bombay and Bangalore some decades ago. It's not anymore. And the aspiration for the kids, to go back again to Somini's chosen words, is really moving in the right direction.
Let me go to
Jane,
the
Vijay's story reminds me, it's a remarkable story, but He really reminds me of one of the stories that I tell in the book, and that's a young woman named Varsha. And Varsha is the daughter of a presswala, someone who has a little business pressing clothes in a wealthy neighborhood. And Varsha is determined not to be either a presswala or a presswala's wife. But Varsha, it's not enough for her just to do well in school, which she has. She also really has to persuade her father, who is her champion. He really loves her. He backs her. But he's also the defender of the very norms that keep Varsha, girls like Varsha, from becoming who they want to be. So she really has to not only do really well in school and, you know, crawl through that little hole in the fence to the other side, but she also has to overcome these deep, deep-seated norms about what girls are supposed to do.
I remember that story. Her father loves her so much, but stops her over and over again from pursuing her dreams. Let me move into the role of women, having brought that up, Somini, in India. Here's an interview from a New York Times piece, 2013, the co-founder and the executive director of a women's right nonprofit called Point of View, talking about gang rape in India. It's a big problem. Indians confront violence against women every day. Here's that.
Somehow what happens in the case of rape is that even though it is on our law books as a crime, there is a mindset that does not see it as a crime. We can make the laws better, but beyond this, what we really need is to work with the laws that we have, make them stronger, and then really work towards implementing them, really work towards getting convictions.
So, Mini Sengupta, you talk about women in the book, and you say the more women push, the more violently they are pushed back, often by men, as young and hungry as they are. How serious is the problem of violence against women in India?
There is no evidence that I've seen that violence against women in India is either going up over the years or is higher than in many other countries. However, it is very clear to me, there is abundant evidence that women are not keeping quiet about it anymore. They are speaking out. And that is really the remarkable change that you see. Women are going to the police to file rape charges, sexual assault charges. They are protesting on the streets, particularly after that really horrific gang rape that the world heard about. And those protests, those movements have resulted in significant changes in the law. And the woman who you whose clip you just played is exactly right. It's a question of enforcing the law. But it does seem to me that because women are much more outspoken about the violence that they face in their homes, on the streets, in the workplace, the chances of the law being enforced are far greater than they were even a generation ago.
Professor Khanna, there are new quotas in India now, so women have access to jobs that they didn't have access to before, as I understand it. How effective has that been?
You know, if I could personalize this for a second, as a father, a husband, father of a daughter, a husband and a brother, this affects everybody. It affects even those among us who are in the so-called elite. When we go to some cities in India, we are extremely careful about particularly the women, when they travel, how they travel. So this is not something that only affects the proverbial other. It affects us all. And I think it's absolutely fabulous that everybody or a lot of people are speaking out. You know, in our own small way, the institute that I directed, Harvard South Asia Institute, catalyzed a massive conversation in the wake of the Delhi incident that so many was just alluding to. And what was really heartening is that after the initial reaction to it, where there is a visceral reaction in India that says, oh, you're an outsider, you're from Harvard, you shouldn't tell us what to do. And it's not as though we were trying to tell people what to do, we were just catalyzing a conversation. But eventually, a lot of people came together, and I must say it was one of the most constructive engagements I have been fortunate enough to see. Look, this is a huge, huge problem. And the quotas that, Jane, you asked about, I think as the clip that you played suggested, they are effective to some extent. They're on paper, but the enforcement, there's many a slip twixt the cup and the lip. There's a long way to go to work on it.
Let's take a call here from Ravindar in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Jane.
Yes.
I love listening to your show. I have lived in India for almost 28 years, and I really do believe that the future of the next generation of India is very bleak. Because, I mean, institutions of India are not working at all. There is a complete collapse of institutions. Executive branch, judicial, legislative. There is extreme corruption in all of these institutions. You cannot even really get, I mean, a birth certificate, marriage certificate, or death certificate unless you bribe the court officials. Mm-hmm. You won't buy milk, 90% of the milk is polluted and adulterated with all formaldehyde, urea. It just looks white, but it's really not a milk. Mm-hmm. Violence, I mean, unbelievable violence. In 1984, they slaughtered thousands of the Sikhs, and there is no justice for them. 1992, they demolished the Marble Mosque, slaughtered thousands of Muslims. Narendra Modi was even banned to enter the United States for 10 years till he ended up becoming the Prime Minister of India.
That's a long list, Ravindar, of problems, which I hear you, and I'm glad you called. For time's sake, I'm going to turn this over to Professor Khanna. I mean, talk to us about, well, for one thing, corruption has been a huge problem in India. Samini, you say in your book, India is the land of and yet. Speak to that first, and then we'll go to Professor Khanna. You say, I think of it as a democracy that makes promises it has no intention of keeping.
Just to the issue of corruption, the other side of that, if I may offer, is that the attention to corruption it has also grown, so much so that there's a group in Bangalore that calls itself I Paid a Bribe. They have a portal online where people go online and say when and under what circumstances they were forced to pay a bribe, and equally, when they refused to pay a bribe. So much has the public opinion against corruption grown that a new political party was spawned a couple of years ago whose mantra was to, boot out politicians who were corrupt.
Mm. So, Professor Khanna, speak to us on this point. The Prime Minister of India is the son of a tea seller. He epitomizes the promise of sort of reinvention. Has he been able to deliver? Are his promises sort of filtering down to those beneath him?
I mean, what's nice about what Mr. Modi has done is generate a lot of enthusiasm among people. Perhaps people were tired of a particular party in power. And the nice thing about democracy is that you get to change the person in power. And I think it's a breath of fresh air. That said, it's an enormously complex task to move an economy like India for all its diverse problems and so on. What I see, at least in my sort of pro bono capacity working with the government in the last year or so, is that there is absolutely an intent to strengthen the institutions that Ravindar correctly pointed out are quite weak, that they have suffered from lack of attention over the years, suffered also from corruption that continues to be a problem. But again, the intent is there. And I always come back to, what should we do about this? What should Ravindar do about it? What should so many do about it? What should I do about it? And my attitude is, let's put our shoulder to the wheel and call a spade and try to fix it.
We're discussing young people in modern India this hour, their future. You can join the conversation. What will it take for India to help its next generation rise? Is India on the right trajectory? We're going out here on the song Afreen from the 2014 movie The 100-Foot Journey. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at India's young this hour and their future in modern India. You can join the conversation. Are you from India? If so, how do you see your country changing? What are your hopes for the next generation? We're speaking this hour with New York Times' Somini Sengupta. She's author of the new book, The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. And with Tarun Khanna, professor at Harvard Business School and director of South Asia Institute at Harvard University. Here's some sound from February. Student leader Kanhaiya Kumar was arrested on charges of sedition. In response to his arrest, thousands of protesters came. They protested outside a New Delhi university. He was released from jail just last week. So, Mini, India is still trying to figure out how much free speech it will tolerate. Talk about the internet and social media and how it's challenging democratic ideals in India.
Yeah, I'm so glad you played that clip. It's really, I think, a moment of identity crisis in some ways for what kind of a democracy India wants to be. And the right to free speech is central to that. I write in my book about a case of a young woman who a couple of years ago was arrested for a Facebook post, and specifically for clicking like on a Facebook post that was a commentary about the death of a political leader. That young woman, two young women, were dragged into a police station, and they were charged under a section of the penal code, and this really made a lot of young people of their generation revolt. So much so that the case went to the highest court in the land, to the Supreme Court, and the law under which they were arrested was reversed. What you're seeing now with the case that you just played a clip of is somewhat similar. You have the case of a young man who is a student leader at a very prestigious university in Delhi. He himself is a very model of aspiration. His parents are working folks, and he came to this prestigious university to get his PhD. He spoke at a rally defending his fellow students' right to free speech, and he was charged with sedition. And what you're seeing now on the streets of India is a real polarization between one side that says certain kinds of speech that they consider to be unpatriotic, what they call anti-national, should not be allowed. And another that says, you know, India is not like China, India is not like North Korea, that India's very credibility as a thriving democracy depends on its citizens' ability to say what they want, offline and online, so long as it does not incite immediate violence.
Let's get a caller in here from Weston, Florida. Svita is on the line. Svita, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, of course.
I have a quick comment. It's not a question. I just wanted to say that I went to India last year after 3.5 years, and the society is changing, the country is changing, the young generation is much more confident than it used to be when I was growing up over there. And because of social media, because of so much awareness, globalization, in spite of everything that is wrong and in spite of everything that, like, you know, that's taking time, there is no stopping people from getting what they want. And India has a very, very positive outlook, according to me. And in spite of all the problems, people are working towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be good. Maybe a couple of generations down the line.
Savita, thank you. Tarun Khanna, there's someone who shares your optimism, for sure. No stopping this, do you believe? I mean, in a couple of generations, will India look completely different than it does now, Professor?
Well, I tend to share the optimism, but I think it's really important to be realistic that this is a work in progress. And in the incident that we were just talking about, the JNU incident, there are some things to be incredibly concerned about and distressed about. And on the other hand, there is a debate and a deliberation going on in the courts, in the public media. The media is not shying away from discussing this. Intellectuals are speaking up. And I think that should be celebrated. It's a discourse that is productive and helps India find the way forward in what I hope would be a constructive way.
What an interesting conversation. My thanks to both of you. Tarun Khanna, professor at Harvard Business School, director of the South Asia Institute at Harvard University. Thank you, professor, very much.
Thank you, Jane.
Somini Sengupta, author of The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. Somina, thank you very much for your work and for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, we remember Nancy Reagan. This is On Point. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan died on Sunday at the age of 94. She was deeply devoted to her husband, a fierce protector of his legacy, and a political figure herself. To remember her, we turn now to Mona Charon, who served as Nancy Reagan's speechwriter during the 1984 presidential race. She's also a syndicated columnist and political analyst and senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mona, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So speak to us first about Nancy Reagan as a fierce guardian of her husband's image. Tell us about her as a in that role.
Right. So Nancy Reagan, as you know, had this kind of storybook marriage to Ronald Reagan. They were mad about each other and protected one another, I would say. He was very concerned about her at all times and vice versa. Her concern extended to his image. She worried about bad PR. She worried about people who surrounded him that, from her point of view, might not have had his best interests at heart. And so she played a role, for example, in him choosing to fire his campaign manager when he was running for president in the primaries in 1980. It's a big move. She played a role in trying to defuse the huge PR problem that the president ran into in his second term regarding a visit to a cemetery in Germany that included some Nazis. So she was a very, very active participant in his presidency and, of course, the light of his life.
Longtime Reagan aide Michael Deaver said, without Nancy, there would have been no Governor Reagan, no President Reagan. Really, to some extent, his most trusted advisor, no?
I think that's absolutely right, and it's because she was a source for him of so much emotional strength and stability. Some of his love notes to her are on display at the Reagan Library and Museum in Simi Valley, California, which is a beautiful spot, and I highly recommend it, and a great museum. Highly recommend it. But they've put some of his little love notes. I mean, when they were separated, he was constantly jotting off little notes about how much he missed her and couldn't wait to be reunited and so on. And whenever they were in the White House, they were always in the same room. You know, it was a really noticeable. They were really, really close, and that kind of intimacy and strength and solidity gave him the personal security and the personal space to be able to then devote himself to his worldly pursuits with that kind of fundamental ballast in his life.
Here's Nancy Reagan describing what it meant to her to be married to Ronald Reagan.
I think I was born to be married. I was the happiest girl in the world when I became we.
Hmm. She was an actress, right? She started out as an actress before she even knew Ronald Reagan.
That's right. And her mother had been an actress as well. So there were a number of generations of actresses. Reagan, of course, was an actor. And she contrived to meet him. I mean, she admitted later that it was kind of a contrivance. But there was another Nancy Davis, who was an actress, who had been caught up in the Un-American Activities Committee investigations and might have had communist ties. And he was the head of the Screen Actors Guild, and she said, clarify that she was not that Nancy Davis and have other people understand that, too. But, of course, they met for lunch or whatever it was to drink to discuss this little problem, and things just took off from there.
Here's Nancy Reagan. She appeared in the 1957 film Hellcats of the Navy with Ronald Reagan, which would be the last of her 11 films.
I began to think maybe you were playing the South Sea Circuit. You knew better.
How could I know? Did you give me a post-dated check?
And here is Nancy Reagan speaking about Ronald Reagan's turn from acting to politics.
In Ronnie, the party saw a fresh face, a popular and nationally known figure with no ties to Washington, and a reputation for integrity.
So speak to that turn that Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan made really together from acting to politics, Mona Charon.
Well, it was something that that Reagan decided. He had always been interested in public affairs, but only in a tangential way. It was because, as I mentioned, while he was an actor, he was the head of the Screen Actors Guild. But that experience was very formative because there were communists who were always attempting to take over the union. And he saw the tactics that they used and the violence that they were capable of and the treachery. And he decided at that point that the communists were quite the menace that had to be fought. And then he educated himself and learned that this is the way they behaved everywhere. And it was the beginning of his political interest and awakening. And it led him eventually to become conservative and highly anti-communist. And he won the Cold War. Little small little detail.
She was also not without controversy, Nancy Reagan. I mean, there were a lot of stories in the day of her high fashion taste, redecorating the White House, consulting an astrologer after the assassination attempt. Speak to that.
Right. So, in the very beginning of the administration, she got a lot of heat for bringing glamour back to the White House and for spending too much money. Well, for example, some of this was completely unfair. It was really just targeting by the press. I mean, a lot of first ladies redecorate all the time, and it's just considered normal, but the press decided to focus on her. She got a new set of china for White House functions. She did it through private donations, but people didn't make that little distinction. They left that part out, and they said, she's buying new china, and here we are. The people are struggling. All right, and she got heat for wearing designer clothes. So she decided to, one year at the Gridiron Dinner, which is attended by members of the press and then high officials do little skits where they do little musical skits. It's a jokey kind of evening. She came out and did a routine called Secondhand Clothes, based on Secondhand Rose, and it brought the house down. I mean, she was making fun of herself, and she came out wearing this completely wild outfit, and I think it utterly defused it. It showed the press that she could have a sense of humor about herself, and it really, I think, changed the trajectory of coverage. After that, you saw very few stories about White House extravagance.
Dark side here. After the assassination attempt against her husband, President Reagan, on March 30th, 1981, Nancy Reagan talked about how difficult that was and how she feared for his safety.
Every time he went out and talked to thousands of people, my heart stopped.
That affected her deeply.
Yeah, it did, and arguably led to one of the worst lapses in judgment that she was guilty of during her time as First Lady, and that was in consulting, basically resorting to superstition and consulting with an astrologer about the president's travel schedule. Now, there's sort of a backstory here about how this all came out, and maybe that's not so important. She was sort of feuding with Don Regan, who was the president's chief of staff. Anyway, the fact is, it was a mistake, and it was something that, it made her feel better. And from what I was given to understand from people who were still in the White House at the time when this story came out, I had already left by then, but what I heard was that the president did not actually do what the astrologer said, but more gave Nancy, humored her and said he would listen to the astrologer. So,
well, let me ask you about her husband's Alzheimer's, because so many people related to Nancy Reagan because of her struggle with her husband's disease. Here she is speaking out about Ronald Reagan's Alzheimer's disease at the Republican National Convention in 1996.
We've learned, as too many other families have learned,
of the terrible pain and loneliness that must be endured as each day brings another reminder of this very long goodbye.
It was a long goodbye, Mona.
It was terrible. It was a terrible, protracted departure for Reagan, where he lost more and more awareness and finally at the end did not even recognize her. And it was, of course, agonizing and heartbreaking for her. But she was so devoted to him and was by his side throughout the years of his long decline. And I think actually was quite heroic in that last phase of his life, where, you know, she was not really so much a companion at the end, but just a nurse. And she did all that. She did it uncomplainingly and lovingly. Mm.
Last question here, Mona Sharon. Who was Nancy Reagan at heart when she wasn't associated with Ronald Reagan?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to think of her without him, because their lives melded so completely. She was a gracious person. She had a great sense of dignity about her. She was ambitious. She was... she was bright. She was aware. But all of those things were knitted into her union with one of the great presidents in American history.
Nancy Reagan, dead at the age of 94. Mona Sharon served as Nancy Reagan's speechwriter during the 1984 presidential race and is a syndicated columnist and political analyst. Mona, thank you very much for the remembrances.
My pleasure.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.